This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Douglas knows the criminal mind. He was the founder and head of the FBI Special Investigative Unit and is one of the country's leading criminal profilers. He examines all the evidence from a crime scene and constructs a personality profile of the suspect, from their upbringing to the type of car they drive. He was the model for the character Special Agent Jack Crawford in Jonathan Demme's film Silence of the Lambs. While he still works as a profiler, Douglas retired a few years ago from the FBI after more than 25 years. Douglas has been called in to investigate many high-profile cases and has interviewed Charles Manson, Richard Speck, David Berkowitz, also known as Son of Sam, and Ted Bundy. John Douglas has co-authored a number of books about his work, and his latest is called Obsession, and is about predatory killers, rapists, and stalkers. Their goal, he says, is manipulation, domination, and control. I asked Douglas how he goes about constructing a criminal profile.
This is very different than the show Millennium or the show Profiler, where they seem to have an out-of-body experience. You know, sometimes people think that I must have had this. You know, when I come up with some sometimes very detailed and specific characteristics. But the first thing is you have to go into the went into the penitentiaries to really interview the experts, the people who perpetrate the crimes, the rapists, the murderers, from a law enforcement investigative perspective, not from the perspective of rehabilitation. I just totally don't believe in it, particularly with sexual predators. So, in essence, I walk in their shoes to get a feel and understanding for them.
What do you ask them? What do you want to know from a predatory criminal?
Okay. What I'd like to know from a molester, abductor, is, okay, why do you go into a shopping center looking for children? And they said, well, today the trend is for parents are dropping their kids off at these shopping centers, particularly at the toy stores and particularly at the video arcades. Okay, then what are you looking for? I says, well, I can spot the child, like the lion on the Serengeti Plain, the child that is not being well cared for, that has low self-esteem. When you look in their eyes, the eyes appear to be vacant. The child is physically, the clothes aren't well taken care of and cared for. And what do you do? Then he says, I go up to the child, and I offer tokens to play the games in the video arcade. And at some point, I will actually physically touch the child and to see touching the child, just even on the shoulder. And if the child is okay with that, then I proceed and get friendly with the child, and then I'll develop a ruse or con to get that child out of that store. And then once they get the child out of the store, it may end into sexual assault and homicide. Then I want to know, you know, why did you kill the child? Why did you select this disposal site over another? And also, did you follow the press? I'm asking questions that I'm looking for patterns that I can apply.
I'm curious how you conduct an interview like that. If you're dealing with someone who is a repeat offender, a predatory sex offender, what do you do to show them that you're, in a sense, in control and command of this situation? Yeah. Are there certain things you'll put on the table to disarm them, to unnerve them, or how much are you looking for their body language?
Yeah, okay. It's kind of the opposite. I have to let them be in control let them manipulate and dominate and let them think that they're controlling me, but I'm letting them do that. If they want to sit up on top of a chair to be above me, to have eye contact above me, yeah, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. But I really have to stroke their egos, and I found it was very effective to do nighttime interviews versus daytime interviews. They felt very much more at ease and comfortable. And the thing about it was is that they never had anyone to talk to who knew their crime, who looked at the case, who looked at the crime scene photographs. Because if I did see something where they were starting to lie to me, like they will do, they'll test you, and I'll say, hey, knock off the BS here. I said, I've seen the crime scene photographs. I've known what you do. I don't care about that, but gosh, you're good. You know, how are you able to elude us? Did you follow the press? Did you respond when the police chief said, you know, we have no new leads? So when I get through this with them, they don't want you to leave. They want to spend hours with you. They want you to come back. They get off on it. I'm there. My mission is to get information. People think, well, gee, you're just as bad as they are. No, if you asked me after the interview, would you pull the switch on these guys? The answer is yes, I would volunteer to pull the switch. I have no care or concern for these people.
When you're talking about predatory criminals, does someone develop their particular modus operandi, that they have a certain way that they're going to either select the person that they're going to kill or kill them the way that they kill, or perhaps even leave the crime scene in a certain kind of way, a way that you can connect it.
Right. There's it all starts with fantasy with these people. And oftentimes the fantasy is starts way early in adolescence. And the fantasy is interesting. In their mind, there's a preferential victim. The way this victim should look, the way they think the victim is going to react when confronted by the subject. But interesting enough, when you start linking cases together where you see victims that are dissimilar, that doesn't mean that you have multiple offenders. If the person is after a particular age group or particularly look of a woman, say a blonde, 30 years of age, if he cannot find that victim, he will not bypass a brunette who's 50 years of age. So, and the other thing is on the modus operandi is if you don't catch him early enough, the modus operandi is perfected. And they get better at it. That's right. They get better and better at what they do. But the way you link cases together, if you possibly can, is to look for a signature, the signature. And the signature is something that the subject does that is unnecessary to perpetrate the crime. To give an example, it could be torture. Stephen Pinnell in Delaware tortured his victims. There was evidence of torture. A guy by the name of George Russell in the state of Washington, he would pose his victims after death. In the case of rape, where officers sometimes they don't ask the right questions, by eliciting responses from the victim regarding the verbal, the sexual, and the physical assault, we're able to determine what the signature was. And the signature may be just the subject's into degrading of the victim, or he's sadistic with this victim, which is really unnecessary.
You call these interpersonal crimes, that they involve a very intense kind of relationship.
Right.
If you're looking at the perpetrators of these crimes and you're going back to their childhoods, kind of piecing together what their early family life was about, are there some connections there? Do you see that there were signs of, what, abuse or neglect, something within the family?
You do see that, but you can't make the quantum leap and say that everyone who's the victim of a child abuse or neglect is going to turn out to be a serial murderer or, oftentimes with women, prostitution or turn to drugs. But of the violent offenders who I've interviewed, who I've researched, almost without exception, you do see this dysfunction. You see animal cruelty. You see enuresis, which is bedwetting, and you also see evidence of arson.
Fire setting.
We call that the homicidal triangle. And people will come up to me, particularly school teachers. They say, "We're seeing these characteristics now. This student who is just anti-everything, anti-authority, who is the bully in the class, and just has this meanness, this streak. But they feel helpless because they have to put this child, at the end of the day, back into that dysfunctional environment. And people ask me, well, how can you turn it around, the violent trend in this country? Really what you'd have to do is to have the kind of monies that we put out in the Persian Gulf War commitment and personnel, millions of dollars, maybe billions, and provide loving, nurturing homes for these children, taken out of this violent environment, and you can change the cycle. But the way things are going, it's not going to change.
Can they compartmentalize their life to the point where they can have a family, a job, be looked upon as a good neighbor?
Oh, sure. I had a case in Alaska where I was sent up there, where there was a suspect, and I did an assessment of a suspect. He was a baker in the community, and looking at him, he did have some very low self-esteem. He had a speech impediment. I think that hurt him and caused him to fuel the low self-esteem. But here was a guy who would, when his wife was away and he had a daughter, he would go on the strip picking up women, prostitutes. He would take them back to his house for 3 or 4 days where he would torture them sexually and physically. He then would take them out to his airplane. He would fly these women up into the wilderness upstate in Alaska, land his aircraft on a frozen lake, take the women out of the airplane, strip them down and hunt them down like a wild animal. Now here's a guy. This guy looked like Harvey Milquetoast when you would see him. People would say, he doesn't look like a serial killer. And that's the problem. What does a serial killer look like? They don't have a third eye. There's not an X on their forehead. There are different types of men who commit these types of crime.
You talk about four different kinds of rapists. And perhaps you can give us a quick thumbnail sketch, yeah. a profile of yeah. of these four different kinds of rapists.
Yeah. Okay. The there's four types. They all center around anger and power. The most common one that in this country that makes up about 80% of the rapists is what we call the power reassurance rapist. He's also known as the gentleman rapist. It's a misnomer, but it's the gentleman rapist. And the reason for that is during the actual assault, once he has the victim under control, he's trying to make the attack pleasurable for the woman. We call him the unselfish rapist. And he's asking questions about the victim's personal life, her sexual history. He's apologetic. He's generally someone who lives in your immediate vicinity.
But is he sincere?
He is, at that time, he is, there's some sincerity there, and that's why he may hang around. He doesn't want you to see him, so he'll come in either wearing a face mask, or if he doesn't wear a face mask, he'll put a pillowcase or pillow over the victim's face, and please, as women, don't look at him. If he says, don't look at me, you do not look at him. And if he's trying to engage in conversation, what you have to do is survival identification. Mm-hmm. You really should personalize yourself and engage in conversation back with with this individual. Really, unfortunately, if you wake up with a knife at your throat, you're really looking for survival here. If you yell or scream, you could get yourself killed. I mean, this person will kill you if it looks like he may get caught. So you have to be careful. And this is the kind of guy too who may be doing work around your house or in your apartment, and he gathers intelligence information on you. The exploitive kind of a rapist, he is the type who will you go into a particular store, and the woman behind the counter says, "It's a robbery." He says, "Oh, please, I'll do anything you say. Please don't hurt me." And the lights go on. He ends up taking advantage of her, and he ends up raping her. And then there's this anger retaliatory. That person is generally married. He's in a relationship with a woman, a girlfriend, wife. And there's a falling out here. But rather than strike out at the wife or the girlfriend, he goes on the hunt looking for a victim where he can dish it out. And he's pretty vicious, and those kind of cases could, in fact, lead to homicide.
Hmm.
The worst, and they're all bad, but then the worst one that does oftentimes evolve into homicide is a sadistic serial rapist. Because no matter what the victim does, no matter what the victim says, please don't hurt me, I'll do anything you say, their goal and their strategy is to put the fear of God in this woman and to punish the victim. Some of these people go so far as to even make audio tapes of the actual assault, of the actual torture.
Well, these are four types of rapists, but I'm, if God forbid you're in a situation like this and you're being raped or being victimized with the threat of rape, you don't have a lot of time to kind of figure out, well, who the heck am I dealing with?
You can't say that. You're right. You can't say, well, I'm going to turn to page 32 here.
But what do you suggest, that people be cooperative, that no matter what the person says, that you comply?
It depends where you are. A lot of my colleagues don't like to give that information out. I disagree. For example, if it's an outdoor case in that shopping center, or it's someone flags you down, like there's something wrong with your vehicle, you don't ever want to get in that person's car. Now, if this person confronts you in a parking lot and has a knife, I'd rather see the victim stabbed than to get into, in fighting and screaming and yelling, than to get into that vehicle, because now you can, you're a threat. You can easily identify this person. You can identify his vehicle. And the probabilities in that kind of a scenario is this person has a criminal history, and he's probably done similar crimes in the past. And so he knows that, dead people tell no tales. So you'll probably will lose your life. The other, if you still don't have a chance, and you're taken away with that type of person, you really have to, again, personalize yourself and even make up things if you have to, and maybe you'll be able to touch a soft spot about maybe you have an illness maybe your child is sick. I saw one case, just so I give an example, one woman who in fact was a prostitute, and she thought she could make it pleasurable for the guy. Well, the guy who was raping her just broke up with his girlfriend who was cheating on him. So he was out. He was a serial rapist. And so by her saying, gee, this is very good, you're great, and kind of have a date with you in the future, in his mind now, he said, John, he says, just told me that all women are nothing but whores. Mm-hmm. So now it became mm-hmm. easier for him to kill this victim. So you have to, you have to rely on your instincts and your gut reaction, which in a matter of seconds, you have to make this decision.
We'll talk more with criminal profiler John Douglas after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Criminal profiler John Douglas is our guest. We're talking about getting inside the mind of predatory criminals, which is the subject of his new book, Obsession.
Let me talk to you a little bit about stalker profiles, and you describe the relationship between the stalker and the person that is being stalked. But let's talk about these two different profiles, the love obsession and the simple obsession. What's the love obsession?
The love obsession is the type of stalker that we read about a case every two or three years, such as we have right now, Steven Spielberg. He was stalked by a man who wanted to sexually assault him and kill him, or Madonna, or the Chapman who stalked the Beatles, John Lennon.
John Lennon, yes.
And so those persons are really asocial, isolated individuals whose fantasies and relationship, probably with the TV, is greater than it is with other people. But they reach a point in their lives where they feel the only way to gain recognition or attention is to become part of that particular person, even though the way to become part of that person is to kill the celebrity. And so there's no plan as far as escape. Once they kill the celebrity, it's all over with. But it generally, and that's why you have to be careful with the celebrities. There's generally, these people will start writing letters. You have to warn the celebrities. It's probably not a good idea anymore to send photographs out, answer letters. Because once if you write a letter or two answering this letter, then you stop, then there's this anger and this hatred. And I'm not going to say that there's thousands of people like that, but there's certainly enough of them where it should be a concern for the celebrity.
But the stalker under this kind of love obsession, they don't know this person,
right,
but they both love them and hate them. I mean, there's something about them that has kind of mesmerized, I guess, the stalker, but then there's the other part of...
Because they're delusional. They have this highly systematized delusional system. You'll find, when you do searches, you'll find they have scrapbooks of photographs and newspaper articles. And when you're assessing a potential threat, you have to see whether or not this person, say the person is in Philadelphia, now the celebrity is coming to Philadelphia, you should be on high alert, because this person now will probably try to get close to you and may attempt to assault that celebrity.
Well, what about the simple obsession stalker?
Okay, now that's the person. That could be you or I. And at any given moment in this country, there are over 200,000 people who are being stalked. It's an unbelievable statistic. In fact, by the end of the year, there'll be about 1.5 million people will be stalked by someone. And a woman, every woman in this country, 1 out of 20 will be stalked in their lifetime. And there's a very fine line between domestic violence and stalking. And many of these domestic violence cases, and these cases we read about every day where there's a homicide / suicide, or just the homicide and the guy ends up surrendering, starts off in a domestic relationship where the person is very, very nice initially, showers this woman with gifts and is very, very thoughtful, but then it's very systematic. They end up wanting this woman to have no contact with outside people. They don't want them to work. They want you to cut off any relationships with families.
It's all about control, domination,
that's right.
Power.
Definitely, definitely control. The person, the male, has very, very low self-esteem. There may be now actual threats of violence, and the woman will be assaulted. Now, if the woman is assaulted around the face and neck, say slapped or strangled, the chances are now that you're going to be even more brutally attacked in the future is great. In fact, you may even be killed, because it's telling me it's a very personal. There's a lot of personal aggression being directed, at you.
Well, talking about interpersonal crimes, and your book is about stalkers and rapists and serial sexual killers. Is there, from your vantage point, is there the possibility of rehabilitation with people like this who commit these kinds of crimes?
Rehabilitation, no, because what you're assuming then when they say rehabilitation is that means that they were habilitated to begin with. So how can you rehabilitate somebody who wasn't even normal or correct to begin with?
But what about intensive therapy, a behavior modification, even the use of testosterone-lowering drugs, things like that?
Yeah, like Depo-Provera that they use at Johns Hopkins University. No, because I've seen cases with that. Again, these are crimes of anger. And I even had the judge want to castrate a rapist in Texas. And hey, judge, this is a crime of anger. I says, you castrate him. I think this could be a pretty angry individual. And if you're using drugs like Depo-Provera or one most recently developed somewhere in Europe this past 2 weeks, what I don't like about it is that they don't really test them. They do an interview, and they rely on self-reporting. Well, how do you feel, John? Do you still get this need or urge to go out and molest boys or go and molest the women? Oh, no, Doc, this stuff is really working. I think if it's young enough, if you're young enough with the therapy, but not if you're already on track, and now you're telling me this person's in his 20s, mid-20s, 30s, 40s, it's like you cannot change the sexual preference. You cannot. It'd be like trying to change my sexual preference. It can't be done.
Do people outgrow, though, crimes like this, that if they're kept in prison long enough into, say, their 60s or 70s, chances are that will put a stop to repeat offenders?
Yeah. I mean, if the person is being wheeled around in a wheelchair, yeah, that's a problem. But look at the guy who in California, he chopped off the arms of a girl he held hostage, and then they released him, which is unbelievable. He then goes down to Florida, and he's 70-plus-something years, and he ends up murdering a woman down there. You see, the psychiatrists and psychologists try to think of that there was a connection between the testosterone and the aggression and the sex, and it has nothing to do with that. This is, the anger. This is the domination. This is control.
John Douglas's new book is called Obsession. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.